Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Our first guest is a man who knows a lot about intelligence briefings. He's done it most of his life. He is, in fact, a career intelligence professional, now the Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs at the Center for Security Policy. I'm very pleased to say he is, of course, Fred Flights. Fred, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Frank.
You have written at the center's website, securefreedom.org, a rather pointed piece about the man who spent 11 or so hours on the floor of the United States yesterday, the United States Senate yesterday, holding up action on the reauthorization in one form or another of critical national security intelligence collection capabilities. Talk about Rand Paul's filibuster, Fred, and what he's saying and why he's wrong in what he is saying.
Well, Frank, there's a lot in flux about this. It was billed as a filibuster, but it really wasn't, since it didn't delay any legislation. It seemed to have been a negotiated ploy that Paul worked out with McConnell, where he would have an extended amount of time to talk about this bill with other people who don't like it. And what the bill is, something called the USA Freedom Act, which would extend parts of the Patriot Act, which authorize the metadata program, a program that collects phone records, not the content of phone calls.
So that's the legislation that's in question, not Senator McConnell's effort to simply reauthorize for a period of time the Patriot Act itself?
Well, Senator McConnell has another bill which would extend the Patriot Act the way it is, basically extend the metadata program without any changes. There seems to be almost no chance that's going to happen. Now, the Wall Street Journal thinks McConnell's right. National Review thinks McConnell's right. I think McConnell's right. But unfortunately, the metadata program has been hurt so badly by leaks by the traitor Edward Snowden and political gamesmanship by people like Senator Paul. I'm afraid the only way to extend it probably is the USA Freedom Act, which, I mean, it hurts the program badly, but at least it'll still be around.
And the question that then arises is, so why is a guy like Chris Christie pointing out, among others, that this is really very ill-advised from the point of view of the national security? You've made that argument as well, but Fred, if we are going to see these programs interrupted or greatly cut back, what are the national security implications to which Governor Christie and others are speaking?
Well, Governor Christie made a surprising speech earlier this week in which he called criticisms by Senator Paul, without naming Senator Paul, baloney. He said these programs are not infringing on the privacy rights of Americans. This program has been carefully overseen, and we need it due to the growing threat from Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Now, Christie comes at this with a special perspective. He's governor of New Jersey. A lot of New Jerseyans were killed during the 9/11 attacks, and he's very concerned about the threat from terrorism, and I give him a lot of credit. Now, Jeb Bush and Senator Rubio have also spoken out in support of this program, but, I mean, Christie was excellent. He explained exactly what's at issue here, that this program does not threaten the privacy rights of Americans, and we need it right now, and people are demagoguing against it for political gain.
Well, that couldn't be more transparent with the way Rand Paul was out promoting his speech to his actual or would-be campaign contributors in the course of yesterday. The other, of course, perspective that Chris Christie brings to this, presumably, is that of a former U.S. attorney. And as you say, his constituency, his district, very much was impacted by the attacks of 9/11. And I'm sure that this has sharpened his thinking on the matter as well. Fred Flights is our guest. He is a career intelligence professional, having worked for some 20 years at the Central Intelligence Agency, also for former ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton, when he was an undersecretary of state, and as a professional staff member on the House Intelligence Committee, now with the Center for Security Policy. And Fred, one of the things that your friend and mine, Mike Pompeo, a member of the House Intelligence Committee representing the 4th District of Kansas, said in an interview we conducted earlier this week on this program is that he's absolutely convinced that the program has saved American lives. And in the absence of it, we might well be putting lives in the future in peril needlessly. Is that your view as well?
It is. And I think Pompeo's statement is an inconvenient fact for people who want to shoot this down, because the metadata program has been consistently supported by the House and Senate Intelligence Committees by a bipartisan majority, not unanimously, by a bipartisan majority. These are the people who know what it has achieved. They know the lives it has saved. They've stood by it. Well, people like Rand Paul has tried to say, well, they weren't doing their jobs. They were co-opted by the intelligence agencies. Frank, I served on the House Intelligence Committee staff. I know how tough they are with these agencies. The congressmen who know this program best support it because they know it works, and that's what we heard from Pompeo.
Indeed, and I thought rather authoritatively as well. Hey, Fred, let me turn to one other topic that's on my mind and yours as well, and that is the piece that you've written about the implications of the fall of Ramadi in Iraq to the Islamic State. It's also making considerable inroads in Syria at the moment as well, and indeed there's some speculation that the Bashar Assad government may be on its last legs as a result of the sort of the combined efforts of Islamic State forces on the one hand and the al-Nusra front, the sort of Islamists of another stripe that are joining in the fight against the Assad regime. What are your thoughts on where we find ourselves now vis-a-vis this collection of jihadists in the Middle East and perhaps well beyond?
We're losing. It's clear that there is no strategy by this administration. Actually, let me take that back. I'm writing a new article. There is a strategy by President Obama. It's to do as little as possible in Iraq and Syria and ISIS and hand this mess to the next president. He's approved sending in some military advisors, a small number of airstrikes, but his heart isn't in it. He doesn't want to do anything in Iraq and Syria because he wants to be the president who got us out of wars. And that's why we have troops in there who are not allowed to be in forward positions. They're not allowed to help spot for bombing raids. And the Iraqi army is hurting. It's not adequately trained and armed to take on ISIS. That's why we had this catastrophe in Ramadi, and I think it's going to get worse.
And to the extent that there is further erosion in our position there, when I say our position, I mean the interests of those who believe that losing territory to either, for that matter, the Sunni jihadists or the Iranian-backed Shiite jihadists, what would your counsel be as to a course of action other than the one that the administration is taking of doing as little as possible?
Why Ramadi is so bad is because it's going to widen the divide further between the Shiite government and Sunnis in Anbar province. And this is going to drive support to ISIS. I think we have to build bridges with the Sunnis in Anbar province so they will take on ISIS. We have to arm the Iraqi Kurds. We have to press the government in Baghdad to start working with Sunni tribes and maybe establish a Sunni National Guard to take on ISIS. And we have to get Iran out of Iraq. We are actually using Iran as a proxy to fight battles in Iraq because we don't want to send in troops. This is driving support to ISIS. This has to stop.
And Fred, just in closing, is it your view that what we are doing with respect to Iran beyond Iraq, notably the effort to negotiate a deal with them on their nuclear program and to shower money upon them, perhaps as much as $50 billion just for signing on to a deal, is likely to make matters worse in Iraq or better?
We are empowering Iran to become a regional hegemon with the mistaken idea that if we give them a nuclear deal and we work with them, they will become a responsible member of the international community. All evidence proves that's not true. They're promoting instability throughout the region. They're still backing terrorism. They're backing the Assad regime. I can't think of a more wrong-headed policy
I can't either. And unfortunately, if we could, I suspect it'll be embraced by the Obama administration. So stay tuned. Fred, we'll have to leave it there for the moment. Thanks for the terrific work you're doing at the Center for Security Policy these days, and of course for your past service to our country and numerous other capacities, particularly in the intelligence field. Keep it up. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll be speaking with Rick Manning. We'll get his update from the Americans for Limited Government on this whole question of the fast-track authority and why on earth Congress would give it to the President of the United States. That more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Rick Manning, the president of Americans for Limited Government, formerly one of the senior members of the U.S. Department of Labor during the George W. Bush administration, a man who knows his way around Washington and most especially understands what needs to be done to try to keep Washington from becoming an even bigger problem for all of us. And one of the things that he has talked about with us and elsewhere extensively of late in that very regard is this question of giving President Obama more and more ill-advised authority, specifically with respect to negotiating trade agreements, so-called fast-track authority or the trade promotion authority. Rick Manning, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
I wanted to get an update on what's happening with all of this, Rick. You've had some rather signal success with actual or prospective candidates for the Republican nomination for the presidency indicating that they don't think this is a good idea either. Talk a little bit about that.
You're right, Frank. We've had amazing success. We have now 8 Republican presidential aspirants who have expressed that they outright oppose or have grave concerns that would vote against fast-track trade authority for President Obama. You know, most of those concerns are based on a simple premise, and that is, after years of watching President Obama abuse his authority, expand his authority, use his pen and his phone to grab power, you know, these presidential aspirants are talking to real voters, and those voters are saying, why would Congress ever allow this guy to have more power without having full and complete scrutiny over anything he does? And so they're responding to that, and we now have everybody ranging from Bobby Jindal and Mike Huckabee and to Chris Christie opposed to this. And we are just, every single day we see a new presidential aspirant. There's so many of them, it's hard to keep up, but we see a new one who's moving in our direction. Even Rick Perry, who initially said that he supported it because he likes trade, a week later, just 2 days ago, came out and said, well, maybe this is the wrong deal for the wrong guy. So every single one of these guys is coming out and saying, this is just not the right time, right, not the right president to give him more power.
Rick Manning is our guest. He is the president of a wonderful organization in Washington, Americans for Limited Government. He is well known in the Washington community, notably for columns he publishes in places like The Hill, in Vistor's Business Daily, at foxnews.com and elsewhere. Of course, we're always delighted to have him with us here at Secure Freedom Radio. And Rick, you were talking a bit about how the presidential contenders on the Republican side are jockeying for position with respect to this idea of giving the president the authority to negotiate on basically a take-it-or-leave-it basis, as far as Congress is concerned, new trade deals, including this so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. How do things look on Capitol Hill, where the question of this kind of authority is actually going to be decided in the near future? We had the Senate approve it, of course, recently. What are you saying is likely to happen in the House?
Well, in the House, the proponents of this have a huge problem. The Democrats are almost lockstep against it because they don't like the concept of free trade. And there are close to 50 to 60 House members who are would be opposed on the Republican side. And so they're basically blocking the pathway for passage in the House. And it's really an interesting phenomenon, Frank. When we talk to House members, while they don't want to give the President Obama any more power, the allure of free trade and the idea of free trade is very significant to them. But the more they look at what's actually in this TPP from publicly available documents and the like, recognize the TPP itself is a secret document, and individual members of Congress can go down and read the 600 to 800 pages, but they can't take notes, they can't do anything like that. So a lot of this is based on publicly available information, testimony, and other things. The more they learn about it, the less they like it. It's got 27 sections, only 5 of which deal with trade. Of those 22, they're placeholders for everything from immigration to climate change to intellectual property, every single energy, every single thing you can imagine in our economy are covered by this Trans-Pacific Partnership.
And when you say covered, what does that mean? That there's actually new opportunities for people other than our elected representatives to make decisions about how policy or regulations in these various areas are determined?
Yes. There's a trade agreement has the effect of overriding federal and state laws, regulations, everything but the Constitution. And so if Congress ratifies this agreement and they have placeholders, even if it's benign language in it for now, placeholders for every other aspect of the economy within the context of that deal, it would then allow a future president, or this one after ratification, to go back to the member countries and renegotiate those individual sections. And just as a simple thing, on the immigration front, the Japanese prime minister said at the White House about 3 weeks ago that this bill, that the Trans-Pacific Partnership, would allow for an Asian-Pacific free flow of labor, goods, and money. Okay, well, labor is immigration, and it says that the signatory countries are going to have a free flow of labor. That's not subtle. I mean, this is a deal with Mexico. This is a deal with a lot of countries on the Pacific Rim. So that's not a subtle kind of statement. That's very direct. This has direct ramifications on our immigration laws.
Yeah, and sovereignty more generally. And Rick, this is one of the things I admire so much about you and your work at Americans for Limited Government is you are standing up for our sovereignty at a moment when it's clearly under assault by the Obama administration and seemingly by the Chamber of Commerce and by others who are championing this legislation. And Rick, in that regard, one of the other things that's alarming, as I understand it, about this idea of fast-track authority for specifically the Trans-Pacific Partnership is that not only can they come back and kind of renegotiate whatever the Congress thinks is currently in the bill or in the treaty without it actually being brought for congressional assent, but they can actually even add in another country who is currently not in and is actually said to be one of the reasons why this Trans-Pacific Partnership is so important is because China is not part of it, and we need it as a bulwark against China. What on earth is up with that?
Well, you know, it's called salesmanship.
Or deception, if the case is put more pointedly.
DC, salesmanship is often the same thing as deception. But, you know, here's what we know, that a lot of the member countries want China in the deal. Here's what would happen. If you put China, let's just give the President Obama the absolute most amount of trust and faith he's trying to do what's in America's interests. They're putting stuff in there to try to create some environmental laws in these other countries that are that make it so they're competitive with us. They're trying to increase wages in these other countries. Let's assume all that's true, which it isn't, but let's assume that. Here's what happens. China comes into the deal. China says to these countries, you can get the same kind of tariffs from China as you can get from the United States, but we don't care about any of those other things that are in there. We don't really, we use slaves here in China. We don't really care if you use slaves in Vietnam. So we really are going to now use the U.S. negotiated trade deal, eliminate any of this concessions regarding the worker conditions and all that kind of stuff. And we'll eliminate all that. We're not going to hold you accountable. You can do business with us. If the U.S. doesn't like it, tough. Make them, they'll have to cave.
This is the kind of practice that the Chinese have engaged in, of course, with the World Trade Organization and so many other agreements that they've signed. Rick, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid, for the moment. I appreciate this update and look forward to hearing more about what you think is coming up, whether Jim Jordan, for example, in the House is going to lead the charge against this or whether others will do so as well. But that's for another day. In the meantime, be well, my friend. Keep up the good work. Diana West joins us next. We'll talk about remembering betrayals of World War II and perhaps insights into those of today as well. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The flame of American freedom is burning a little less brightly at the moment, dimmed by the loss of one of our nation's most extraordinary patriots. Dr. John Templeton was a pediatric surgeon by training.
a Renaissance man by dint of his extraordinary free-range intellect, and a leading philanthropist by accident of lineage and extraordinary personal generosity. He passed away last weekend after a long bout with cancer. I can honestly say I have never met anyone quite like Jack Templeton. He combined the rarest of attributes, a truly brilliant mind, a visionary clarity about our world, a passionate love of our country, and a commitment to do whatever he could to preserve our liberties. And as it happened, he could and did do quite a lot. Thank you, Jack Templeton. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
On June 22nd, the Center for Security Policy will honor Representative Trent Franks of Arizona's 8th Congressional District and the mayor of Irving, Texas, Beth Van Dyne, at its annual Freedom Flame Award Dinner. The evening will take place at the exclusive Metropolitan Club of New York City. For tickets and more information, visit www.securefreedom.org.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign, at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word: answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Fred Fleisch for the Center for Security Policy. The Obama administration is portraying last week's raid by Army Special Forces that killed a top ISIS official as a big win in the war against ISIS. I agree that this daring raid was a big win, but I regret that it has been overshadowed by bad news in Iraq and Syria. The situation in Syria continues to deteriorate. ISIS and the Al-Qaeda-affiliated al-Nusra Front have gained so much territory that the Assad government is at risk of falling. The capture of the Sunni city of Ramadi over the weekend was a catastrophe for U.S. policy and the credibility of the Iraqi government. If ISIS is on the defensive, as the Obama administration claims, how could it pull this off after months of U.S.-led airstrikes? The answer is that President Obama still has no strategy to deal with ISIS in Iraq and Syria or to defeat the global jihad movement. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is Frank Gaffney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Diana West, a regular feature, I'm very pleased to say, here at Secure Freedom Radio, a blogger par excellence at dianawest.net, longtime syndicated columnist and best-selling author, including Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. Diana West, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. Wonderful to be with you.
Well, American Betrayal, of course, is an extraordinary study of successive betrayals, really, but notably some that we've been commemorating in a fashion, mostly by not acknowledging them, of course, in connection with the anniversary remembrances marking the end of World War II. Talk a little bit about the end game of World War II and some of the betrayals that went down then and how they may be bearing on our circumstances even today.
The end of World War II was obviously a moment of jubilation for the world, the free world, and for the captive nations who had been under Nazi domination for the duration. But there were a number of moving parts that remain unacknowledged, even as they have a tremendous bearing on the state of the world today. And these had to do with the maneuverings of the Soviet Union by the end of World War II, the seizures of anti-Stalinist populations that had moved into Europe during the war, that had actually mobilized as a force against Stalin as POWs of the Germans. These were people that were not pro-German at all. They were Russian nationalists, and they were anti-Bolshevik. There was a tremendous feeling of liberation that people forget about in the initial Nazi assault on Russia, which is such a strange thing to read about, really, because no one can imagine Nazis as liberators. But there were these populations that were delighted to be free of Stalin before, of course, they realized that now they were under Nazi dominion and indeed imprisoned, incarcerated, treated as Untermenschen, as the Jews were, obviously. But even so, there was this population of nearly a million men that were formed into a movement against Stalin. They were not really deployed, but there they were in the West. And indeed, a force of them did liberate Prague at the end of World War II in the month of May 1945.
This is the so-called Vlasov Movement Army, as
yes,
I understand.
Yes, yeah. The Russian Liberation Army, yes. And this movement came to surrender, as so many Germans were also doing at the same time, tried to surrender to the Americans and the British, fearing Stalin, fearing communist incarceration, fearing, as the Russians knew, death or the gulag, because Stalin had declared that, prisoners of war were to be essentially written off, even his own son. I mean, if you were imprisoned by the Germans, you were considered suspect. Anybody who was exposed to the West and the ways of the West was considered a threat coming back. So this was the rationale. The whole thing is very hard for us to grapple with, but this was the state of chaos and misery of these times and these places.
Finish this story of what happened to the Vlasov Army after they liberated Prague.
Yes, they melted away because Prague at this point was being infiltrated by communists. A government council dominated by communists essentially started arresting them and basically saying, you better get away. They melted away, as with others of these strange limbo groups who had left the Soviet Union during the chaos of the war. And they surrendered to the Americans. They hoped for asylum. They hoped not to be returned. They made various deals. They laid down their arms. They had discipline and so on. And certain American officers, high-level officers, sympathized with them and tried to help them. But the word comes down from on high, and we don't know exactly how that all went. That I would be very interested in researching that, frankly, moving forward. But they were essentially turned over to Soviet police, to the Soviet custody, along with another million or so of various kinds of civilians, Russian claimed, Soviet claimed, even people who had fled the Soviet Union, or Russia rather, before the Soviet government came up. So these would have been refugees of the Russian Revolution who were never Soviet citizens, and yet we turned them over. We helped. American forces, British forces, other Allied forces actually were the mechanism of this betrayal. And very often the staging grounds, staging places for this return, for this, quote, repatriation, this forcible repatriation, were the very Nazi concentration camps like Dachau that had just been emptied of Jewish prisoners.
Maybe we could pivot just for a moment to what I gather you consider to be kind of a revisionist theory of what happened in Iraq much more recently, and perhaps a betrayal of a different kind there. Talk about that.
What I see happening, and this is something I'd like to study further as well, but just watching Iraq finally come up in an eruption of debate recently, I would say, you know, 10, 5, 8 years too late. I mean, this, we've been waiting for this debate for far too long.
This is in connection with the questions to George Bush's brother Jeb, among other things, I gather, right?
Exactly. But what I'm seeing is a reportraiting, if you will, or a repainting, rather, of what actually transpired. The narrative that the right, in particular, has set is that Bush's policy was victorious and Obama lost all, whereas I argue and argued along the way that the surge, which was supposed to be the mechanism of this Bush victory, the surge was always a two-stage policy, a two-stage strategy, rather. Part one was the American and Allied military fight to provide security to the Iraqis. Stage two was supposed to follow on stage one, which was successful. The American military effort was successful. Stage two was supposed to see Iraqi national reconciliation. Bush promised us this. This was always the second step. And the end goal was an Iraq ally, quote, ally, that would, quote, stand up as an ally in the war on terror. This was the package. We saw stage one perfectly executed by brave and, you know, forceful American military action. And yet the bankruptcy of the policy was not to understand the climate in which, or the culture in which, this military security was provided. We have an Islamic milieu with all manner of moving parts that were never taken into consideration in the strategy planners' decision-making, because Islam was never taken into consideration in any of the military planning. And so when things went awry or never came together, we never saw national reconciliation, no one understood it, and to this day they don't understand it. But now the whole thing is being rewritten as simply a surge of troops providing security equals victory. And I would maintain that that is a very narrow read of what actually happened and what was supposed to happen. And we will make the same mistake again until we understand that Western solutions to Islamic problems are not it's like a round peg in a square hole. It's not a match.
Let me ask you about a related sort of maybe flipped side of the coin to all of that, Diana West. And you've put up at your website, dianawest.net, a very important piece by our friend Daniel Horowitz about the numbers of Muslims that have been admitted to this country since 9/11. And I think it's fair to say that not all of those Muslims are necessarily a problem for us, but some probably are. And it may go right to the point you've just made about the inherent nature of Islam. Talk a little bit about that.
Yes. Well, the thing about Islamic immigration into non-Islamic societies is that at a certain point of demographic density, the Sharia proponents among them, the more activist people, tend to make incursions into the host society, the host Western society, that they would not if there were just a few people of Muslim culture and background and religion. Once you get to that 1%, 2% point, we have seen in England, for example, and other countries, and certainly in France and other places where the demographic is much higher, you see Sharia being set, and you see that larger Islamic population that may host a smaller number of hardcore activists or hardcore jihadists and so on coalesce into a veritable Trojan horse of Sharia. And this is the threat that you see completely unaddressed. Once again, looking, you know, it's not just in Iraq where we didn't look at Islamic realities. It is with this immigration policy. If you wish to safeguard freedom of speech, freedom of religion, in the West, in a Western tradition, an Islamic demographic is actually an existential threat.
Especially as it grows. Diana West, this is a subject for a further conversation next week. We look forward to having it with you. We've got to let it go at that for the moment. But thank you so much for all you do, notably at dianawest.net, and for your visits with us each week. Come back to us ready to rock and roll on that subject again. Next up, we'll be speaking with Ricky Ellison from the Missile Defense Advocacy Alliance about the fact that we don't seem to have a plan against the growing threat of missile attack. That more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement, and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitch with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the global jihad movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Ginny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Ricky Ellison, a man of many parts, a former three-time Super Bowl winner and a middle linebacker for teams like the San Francisco 49ers, the Oakland Raiders. But also, today, driving force behind another kind of defense, if you will, missile defense. He is the chairman and founder of a terrific organization, the Missile Defense Advocacy Alliance. A good friend and always welcome guest. Good to have you back, Ricky.
Thanks, Frank.
I'd like to start maybe with a sort of update on the threat environment that you're focused on. You noted recently that there is a new report out of the Pentagon about China's missile threats. Give us a short course on that, Ricky.
Well, we've seen just a big increase in their capability, not their intent, their capability to strike all of the United States with multiple long-range ballistic missiles.
And that's coming out of both ground-based systems and sea-based systems, as I understand it.
That's correct. And their advancement with MIRVing, their nuclear warheads, you know, poses that significant threat if there was an intent change in their behavior towards us.
Yeah. Well, I guess the question of intention is always somewhat speculative, and it can change very rapidly, but you're right to focus on capabilities, of course. And one of the things that's happening, as I understand it, Ricky, with those missile warheads is some of them at least seem to be being given the capability to fly hypersonically or at least supersonically or maneuver. These additional capabilities are worrying, are they not?
They're still struggling with the hypersonic. They've had, I think, 9 failures or somewhere at that number of being able to achieve that technology. We're ahead of that. Our hypersonic capability, obviously those are all non-ballistic capabilities. It's inside the atmosphere, but we're still ahead by a year or two so far in that development. We're going to have to deal with that threat. The only capability we have today would be the THAAD, and we would have to extend that range in the THAAD to play in that upper atmosphere besides developing, say, a new hypersonic interceptor or left of launch capabilities to defeat that. But we're still generations ahead, I think, well, I believe.
In terms of our offensive capabilities, but not necessarily in terms of being able to counter this from a defensive point of view.
No, and I think there is actually funding and support going into MDA's budget to look into creating a defense against that hypersonic threat, which I believe is going to be an extended range of the THAAD, current THAAD system.
Well, I should hope so, which brings me to my next question to you, Ricky, and that is, what is going on with our missile defense strategy writ large? You mentioned the Missile Defense Agency, or MDA, and its budgets and so on continue to expend resources, of course. But what is guiding it in terms of capabilities, as you say?
From our perspective, the BMDR, the last ballistic missile defense policy in 2010, is now outdated. This is the threat has changed significantly. We have short-range threats directly by the Russians into Eastern Europe. We've got a more sophisticated threat from North Korea. They are moving towards multiple kill vehicles or miniaturizing kill vehicles, nuclear on their interceptors, a sea-based threat as we saw last week. The old strategy was about a reset to the Russian relationship and building a missile defense capability in Europe that could not defend against Russia and any short-range or medium-range or long-range capabilities. Now we are concerned about protecting those two missile defense sites that are going in. The first one's going into Romania at the end of this year. It has no air defense. There are some serious issues with this, and I think the threat is continuing to escalate in terms around the world on ballistic missiles, but yet our strategy, our acquisition strategy, is based on a flat line acquisition. It's not adhered to any strong strategy that you can integrate everybody into. And that's the reason why both the chief of the naval, our CNO, and the chief of our army wrote that letter, that 8-star letter, questioning where is the strategy basically for efficiency and effectiveness so we can plan ahead and financially create the budget to do that.
Our guest is Ricky Ellison. He is today the chairman and founder of the Missile Defense Advocacy Alliance. And Ricky, yesterday you held a kind of debate, I guess, between one of my old friends and yours, Ambassador Bob Joseph, and a Russian representative. Talk a little bit about, speaking of the Russian threat and its increasing capabilities, what came of that conversation?
Well, we had the honor, and we want to hear from their side. So we had an event up on Capitol Hill, probably 50 or so congressional staffers to listen to this, and we wanted to hear the Russian perspective. So they gave us their military attaché and presented their case, which, again, was outdated, going back to, I think, 2010, complaining that these new missile defense sites in Romania and Poland are against the INF treaty. They're complaining that there's no threat from Iran, and they were stating, you know, we don't have to have a defense there, and they're harmless.
I'm not sure whether it's outdated or whether it's just disinformation, but what did Ambassador Joseph say in response?
We clearly took it to him very strong and went after him on the INF, because they're breaking the INF treaty, as you know, and countered each one of their arguments, but took it to a much strategic level and not looking at missile defense, because this really came down to, as the argument unfolded, was not about missile defense. It's about our ability to move in and influence in Eastern Europe, which they still claim and have in their sphere of power. So, you know, and this has got to be much more than missile defense. We went in a discussion with our nuclear capabilities and deterrent on that aspect of it. But you have to have these exchanges, and I think it's good, you know, because if you don't have counterpoints, the raw message gets through. We were able to certainly enlighten everybody on their messaging.
Well, we'll look forward to having Ambassador Joseph on to talk a bit more about that as well. He's terrific. Let me ask you, I understand you've got an event coming up next week noting a very important development in U.S.-Japanese cooperation on missile defense. Ricky Ellison.
Yes, we do. The Japanese and our government, the Japanese are our biggest partner that we have. They have put in $1 billion, and we have put in $1 billion to build the new Aegis interceptor, the SM-3 Block 2A. That interceptor is going to have 3 or 4 times more range than the current one. It is the one that's going to go into Europe, and it's going to go into our ships, so our ships can have much more room to operate with that capability. So the Japanese and us have that, and we're going to have the first flyout test of it upcoming in a week or two. We're going to fly that missile for the very first time.
Well, needless to say, we'll be very anxious to see it succeed. It's been a terrific program and provides the kind of flexible missile defense capability worldwide that is, as you say so well, Ricky Ellison, increasingly needed. Let me turn lastly. I gather you were in Alaska recently and were extolling the virtues of that as a missile defense base that covers an awful lot of real estate from the ground. Ricky, one of the concerns that has been expressed a lot by notably our friend and colleague, Ambassador Henry Cooper, is that we have a vulnerability in terms of missiles or, for that matter, satellites coming up from the south. Are you of the view that in addition to making the most of what we've got in Alaska, we should also be protecting southern axes of attack from threats in the hemisphere or perhaps at sea?
Absolutely. I think we are vulnerable in numerous areas. Alaska does a good job right now against North Korea, but we have to have more coverage. That's where the third site comes in. We have to have eventually
on the east coast of the United States.
East coast of the United States. But I think one of the better things to do is to start working on recreating the KEI, the mobile long-range interceptor, that can be forward-based, whether it's in the United States in the east coast or down south or even over in Europe. That's the kind of capability that we can extend our battle space and be flexible against the threat instead of just put everything in one silo base, because these threats are now becoming much more mobile. And you saw the submarine-based threat from North Korea and the rogue mobile with the K-18s, that we have to be able to adjust to that. And a fixed site's not going to be the total answer for that.
No, I couldn't agree more. And again, mobility is, of course, a key consideration here, Ricky. And that's one of the reasons why I've been so keen on this whole question of our Aegis capabilities, but also space-based systems, something that I understand Senator Ted Cruz has encouraged to be part of the program going forward in the National Defense Authorization Act. We'll look forward to talking with you about that and much more in the near future. In the meantime, keep up the great work at the Missile Defense Advocacy Alliance. I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.